It's approaching 9:30 in the morning, and the day is a Friday, and I'm awaiting the arrival of a man who could make me very rich. He'll be here in a few minutes, and I am going to have to tell him that I do not wish to become rich after all. Now, you may think it strange not wanting to be wealthy, to have luxury, to live without want, without need, to be able to continue to afford a decent house, a luxury car, foreign holidays, eating out. But that is my decision, and it's a decision I made only too readily after the terrifying visitation of yesterday evening. It was a sickening, gruesome affair, and it left me very, very shaken. Indeed, I wondered until a few moments ago whether I'd ever recover from such a meeting. I'm feeling a little more confident now, though. Some of the shock of it is diminishing. I have time to tell you about it before my visitor arrives. His name is Francis Makepeace, and he's a businessman. He's what you might call one of life's movers and shakers. He has fingers in many pies, shares in large corporations, seats on important committees, ownership of 2 regional newspapers and a group of weeklies, and many other interests that don't immediately spring to mind. He has a deal for me. But why me, you may ask? Well, I've been a mover and a shaker myself, though not nearly in the league of Francis Makepeace. Before I was 32, I had 4 directorships within large companies, one of them in the United States, seats on several committees, including my county's police authority, of which I am now the chairman, and was entrusted to write columns in the financial press. Indeed, the name of Julian Tulliver is well known to readers of the Financial Times, the United Kingdom's most respected daily dealing with business and money. Makepeace and I met at a dinner. Well, in the circles we were moving in, most people met at dinners or other social gatherings. This one was to mark the 25th anniversary of a company on whose board we both sat. I won't pretend that I had as much clout as Makepeace, but I had a place nonetheless and brought influence to bear where I could. I had something, however, that Makepeace did not. Chairmanship of the local police authority. Well, I actually had 2 things that Makepeace did not. The other was huge debts. I'd just gone through an expensive divorce, and some share dealings I had in South Africa had gone belly up, leaving me with a mess, quite frankly. I'd already sold my New York apartment and was on the verge of selling my house in the southeast of England, a house that had been in my family for 3 generations. I'd already written an ad for the sale of my beloved Ferrari F40, ready to send by email to one of the quality motor magazines, and I would have to make do with a more modest vehicle for general use. Still, I'd get by. I could always tell people the car was my estranged wife's and she'd taken it with her, or it was mine but she loved it so much that I'd reluctantly let her have it as part of the settlement. But I digress. Here I was, with the chairmanship of the police authority to my name, and what's more, the ear of the chief constable, Percy Blake. I not only had the ear of the chief constable, but had him in something of a stranglehold, because I knew something of his private life concerning extramarital affairs. Oh, don't get me wrong, Percy knew that I knew, and he also knew, or hoped, that I would say nothing of this to anyone. It was an agreement between gentlemen and between friends. But I knew, and he knew that I knew, and that gave me a good deal of power. Now, Francis Makepeace had committed a felony. He'd been mixed up in some dodgy share dealing of a criminal nature concerning a company right in Percy's patch, and Makepeace was offering to make me a very rich man indeed if I could bring some influence to bear on Percy Blake to get all suspicion suitably expunged from the record. It's not easy for chief constables to do this, since it's not the thing he would be dealing with personally, and so other officers in the force would know about Makepeace's suspect dealings. But Percy could, Makepeace feels sure, pull it off. If he had to. I was all set up to help Makepeace by having a quiet word in the ear of Percy Blake. I was settling down in my study last night at about 11 o'clock, with my 2nd glass of brandy. I decided I would read till about 12:30 and then go to bed. The house still felt far too empty since Amanda's departure a month before. We had no children, not even a cat. I had the place entirely to myself. It was an old house, about 500 years old, and our family had acquired it when my grandfather bought it. I was born and brought up in it, as my father had been. Three of its seven bedrooms were closed and not in use. Two were used as guest rooms. One was my study, and the other was our, that is to say, my bedroom. Last night was very still. A mild October night, cool and cloudy, but with no rain. The silence was almost palpable, indeed uncomfortably so. It felt like the sort of silence you experience before a storm. I wonder now whether something was insinuating itself into my brain in some way, or whether there really were infinitesimal changes in the atmosphere in my study, the changes that are necessary for one to be able to sense the presence of, well, of a ghost. I'd never believed in ghosts till last night. Oh, I'd entertained the possibility that some sort of residue created by certain events might somehow be stored in solid objects, perhaps to be experienced at a future time by someone extremely sensitive. But that would be something for mediums. For my own part, I'd never given it much thought, let alone tried to work out the physics of it. But I can tell you that about 11:15 last night my skin began to crawl, the room felt distinctly colder, and I suddenly gained that feeling you get when you sort of know that someone is with you, even if you can't see him or her. Someone, that is, or something. As the room became colder still, I began to feel a stickiness on my flesh, as though spiders' webs were clinging to my skin. I put my hands up to my face instinctively, but there was nothing untoward. Yet the feeling of stickiness, cold, clammy stickiness, was all over me. It was a hideous sensation. Then something seemed to move behind my chair. I shot out of it and turned to face the newcomer, but there was no one there. I thought I'd perhaps nodded off without realizing it, and the sensation had been a dream. But then I heard a noise to my left and spun to see... Well, it's hard to describe what I saw. At first, the space seemed to quiver, a little like the mirage effect on a hot day as heat rises from a pavement. But there was no heat in this room. What heat there'd been seemed to have been sucked right out of it. Then my reading lamp began to flicker, going off and then coming back on again. The bulb gave off a fizzing, crackling sound.
"Julian," said a voice. "Julian. Look at me." But still I could see nothing. Was I dreaming? I didn't think so.
You eventually wake from bad dreams. With a start, yes, but you wake. I didn't wake from this. My spine tingled and I felt colder still, colder, stickier, and very, very frightened.
"Who are you?" I managed to say. "Julian, look at me," said the disembodied voice.
Then I noticed that the quivering air began to take on shape, but it was very vague. It was as if an energy were pulling molecules from the surrounding air in order to give form to itself. I had now frozen in position and realized I was clenching my fists at my side, unable to release them, unable to take my eyes from the strangely morphing air in front of me. Slowly the figure took on more recognizable shape, but it was still vague. Something resembling human form, yes, but by now, since it had spoken to me, I'd realized that whatever it was would be human. Well, a former human, perhaps. A human that had become something else entirely.
"What do you want?" I managed, but my voice was sounding thin and breathy.
"I want you to help me, Julian. You must help me." The shape resolved itself still more. It was white, a sort of light grey, really, but its form was still vague. A head was recognizable on the body, but no features. Then a sound emanated from the shivering air, almost a keening, a mournful wail of a sound that caused me to shiver more, and soon I realized that the sound was that of crying, a melancholic sobbing, a lament, a mourning moan that rose gradually till... It was almost a howl, but it was a sad howl, a noise whose like I had never experienced before. I stood transfixed, almost hypnotized by this wailing that came from the white mush of a figure before me. Then the being took on more resolution, and I realized it was holding out its hands. Instinctively I shrank back, away, no longer held in such a fierce lock by my fear. "What do you want?" I asked. "You're not real. You can't be."
But I am Julian, it said between sobs. Oh, only too real, but not in your world. Look closely at me, Julian. Look intently at me, at my face. Still cautious, still cringing, recoiling with a sense of dread and disgust, I made myself look at where a face would have been, and the figure took on more resolution, until a face could indeed be made out, as could a body. Some colour came into the figure too, and he seemed to be holding out his hands in pathetic entreaty. From the hands I looked back up at the face, and gasped in horror. It was hideous, wrinkled, burned, the flesh around the mouth missing, one eye covered over with what resembled red melted wax. No hair adorned the head, which was scarred horribly, and a yellow pus could be seen oozing from suppurating sores and wounds. I couldn't hide my disgust, but then felt guilty at having shown it. "Don't worry," said the figure. "I know how you must feel. I know I'm not a pretty sight, exactly." And then something bizarre struck me. This figure was wearing my suit, the one I used for the office, the one I had worn earlier, and would be wearing the following day. But it was tattered and soaked in blood in places. Parts of it were burned away, revealing angry red flesh beneath. It was only the attractive cut of the jacket and such parts of the pattern that remained that had caused me to realize that it was my own suit. "You must help me, Julian," said the pathetic voice again. "How?" I asked, afraid to continue looking at this loathsome figure. Are you really a ghost? Your lips, they're..." "Burnt away?" the figure asked. "Yes, and much of the rest of my body too, and it hurts, Julian. It hurts. I know you're wondering how I can talk without lips. It needn't concern you, Julian. In this realm, we talk directly to your mind. You think you hear my voice." How did you... I couldn't finish the sentence, but the figure seemed to know what I was about to ask. "Motor car accident," he said. "A very bad one. It happens in 2 weeks' time." "2 weeks?" I asked, astonished. "Happens? Not happened?" "Julian, you still don't understand," said the figure. "Look more closely, if you can bring yourself to do so." I did. First at the nose, which was just about intact, then at the forehead, and then I froze in horror. "You can see it now, can't you, Julian? I'm from your future. I am you, Julian." My whole body suddenly seemed gripped by a huge shudder. "But ghosts, I mean..." "Ghosts are in a timeless realm, Julian," he said. "I am your ghost, though you are yet to die, the week after next." "Die?" I asked, incredulous. "Like that in a road accident?" "Yes, a rather nasty accident, not at all pleasant. And this is how you'll be perceived in this realm, wherever you go, and you'll constantly feel the pain of it. It could go on a long time, possibly even forever." I found myself falling to my knees in utter terror, the thought that this dreadful and appalling fate was to befall me, and so soon. "You can stop it, Julian," said the figure, said the other Julian Tulliver. How, I begged. "Just tell me how." And he did. He told me that the disfiguring accident would happen while I was driving a Ferrari. Not just any Ferrari, but a Ferrari F40. "But I'm hoping to have sold it. I mean, I'm about to place an ad in one of the motoring magazines. It's not going to be mine for much longer."
"It is yours, Julian, because tomorrow a visitor calls, and you do a deal. You become suddenly very wealthy, and you feel that you needn't part with your beloved car after all. You must not do that deal with your visitor. You must tell him that you no longer need the money." And then the figure seemed to fall to its knees, much as I had done only a minute or so before. "Please, he said, please save me. You can stop this from happening." And then I realized at once why he wished me to renege on my deal with Makepeace. If what was fated to happen could be changed, perhaps the hideous accident could be avoided. "It's not just a case of not having the car," he said. "It's Percy Blake."
"Percy Blake? The chief constable?" I asked.
"He is in the other car," said the other Julian Tulliver. He's driving at high speed to warn his mistress that his infidelity is about to be exposed. The Ferrari and his Mercedes are involved in the most spectacular crash. He is killed and you are... well, you become like this.
But who's to say the accident won't happen some other way? I asked.
I mean, fate... I trailed off, unable to complete my sentence, but my alter ego latched onto my unfinished thought. It's not just a case of objective reality, the two objects colliding, he said. You are about to do a man a disservice, and for your own gain. I don't understand how things operate yet in the other realm, but some deeds are punished, and yes, if you simply thought not to drive on the day in question, this would happen another way. Believe me, you are fated, and so is Percy Blake. You will be brought together in a horrific road accident if he is under the threat of exposure. However, if he is spared that... His voice trailed, sending more shivers up and down my spine. But the other Julian Tulliver did not need to say any more. I knew what I must do. If it meant being poor for the rest of my life, I knew what I must do. And as I made my decision, the figure before me straightened up. A smile began to form on lips that I realized were now present and full. There was hair on the head. As the figure faded from my sight, I saw the suit, my suit, take on its old quality again. No tears, no burns, no stains. I fell into my chair and sobbed, not with sadness but with relief. Somewhere in time, I had acted on my decision. And now 9:30 comes closer, and Francis Makepeace's car can be heard pulling into my drive, making a satisfying crunching sound on the gravel. He pulls up alongside my beloved Ferrari. Last night's visitation is diminishing in my memory. I'm feeling confident again. The doorbell rings. I find that I take a sudden, deep breath, quite involuntarily. I go to the hall. I open the front door to see Francis Makepeace and show him into my study, where the ad for my Ferrari is visible to me on my laptop computer. I ask Makepeace to sit down. "I know this won't take long," I say. "No, not at all," he says. "I'm sure you've reached a sensible decision." "Indeed I have," I say. I reach over to my laptop. The cursor is already hovering over the email's send button. I send it on its way. "Yes, Francis," I say. "I've reached a sensible decision."
That was The Decision, written and read for us by Andrew John.